Hi there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and if I sound a little better, it's because little by little my sound recording rig is improving. I now have a heavy blanket hanging behind me on advice from John Taylor Williams, my sound engineer in DC, and my pop filter's in place, and my Samson mic is in place on its boom arm, and so on and so forth. So with any luck, this should be sounding better than ever. I'm all alone in London. My wife Alice has gone to New York for a toy fair and a conference on youth engagement in digital media, which is the stuff that she does for a living. So it's me and the baby, daddy-daughter time, having a good time. The kid's two now, and a lot of fun to horse around with. If you're in London this week and you'd like to come and say hello, on Friday I'll be speaking at the Channel 4 Story Conference, which is here in Clerkenwell. You can find out more at thestory.org.uk, and this is being organized by Matt Locke from Channel 4 and my wife, with whom he works. Last time I spoke to you, I enumerated all the short story projects I was working on, and I said, and that's it unless someone comes along and offers me a gigantic amount of money to take on one more because I really want to get to work on my novel. Well, I didn't precisely get offered a gigantic amount of money, but I did get offered a modest sum of money for a very cool project. Some of you may be familiar with something called The Mysteries of Harris Burdick. This is a book published in the mid-80s. They are illustrations and titles from a notional lost collection of children's stories. The stories themselves never existed, just the illustrations and the titles. They're very evocative, and for now 25, 30 years, people have been writing their own stories to accompany these illustrations and captions and titles, and the publisher, Houghton Mifflin, has taken note and have opted to actually commission a series of short stories that will be published in an anthology that are the official blessed stories that accompany these illustrations. Stephen King is writing one. I think Neil Gaiman's up for one. They've asked Salman Rushdie, and they've asked me. So I said yes, because that's pretty good company to be in, and the book is really cool. The illustration I've picked is called Another Place, Another Time. And if you Google Harris Burdick, Another Place, Another Time, you'll find it. I'm not sure exactly the story I'm going to write, but I have this idea that I might write a story about a group of people for whom space is three-dimensional, or rather time is three-dimensional, but space only operates in one dimension and only moves in one direction. So in other words, their relationship with the dimensions are reversed. And in our world, in our space-time, time only moves one way in one dimension at one speed, and space... Well, I guess time moves in two dimensions, technically. And space is three-dimensional, and we can move freely in all three dimensions, or as freely as our apparatus will allow us. And I heard a physicist a little while ago on the radio talking about how extraordinary this is when you think about it, because if space and time are really the same thing, it's kind of odd that we can only move in time in two dimensions and in one direction and at a set speed, whereas space is kind of freely movable. So I'm thinking I might write a short story. When you see the illustration, you'll know why. I might write a short story about the Einstein of this universe who works out that space could also be something that you move in at will instead of something that you are on rails, as it were, moving through at a steady clip. I'm not sure exactly how that'll work, but I'm looking forward to it. I've just been delivered the last of the audio files by John Taylor Williams, by my sound engineer, for the With a Little Help anthology audiobook, and they sound really, really good, and I'm going to be putting those into the podcast feed one at a time once the book comes out, and also soliciting other podcasts to put them in. If you have a podcast, and you'd like one of these extraordinary short story readings to that have already been edited and sound really awesome to put in your feed, let me know, and I'll pass you a copy. And then last, I am now eligible for permanent leave to remain here in the United Kingdom, so I've started studying for the Life in the UK test, which includes things like knowing how to queue properly and what St. David's Day commemorates. It's very English, especially with its emphasis on memorizing a lot of facts as a way of demonstrating your competence to live in the country. So I've begun to revise for it, as they say, study for it, and I'll let you know how that works out. I'm taking the test in a couple of weeks, and I'll let you know how it works out. And then once I've passed that test, it's just a matter of filing the application on June the 7th, and I should know by June the 9th whether or not I'm a permanent resident of the United Kingdom, which would be pretty awesome because it would certainly lessen my immigration woes every year. Anyway, on to the new story. I'm going to read to you some of Clockwork Fagin. I don't know if that's going to be the final title. It's for an anthology of steampunk young adult stories that Kelly Link and Gavin Grant have edited. They have told me that they like the story but want some editing. Haven't told me what yet. They're pretty busy. Kelly had a very premature baby about a year ago. And very, very premature. And they've been going through a lot of really tough medical stuff as a result of this, and they've had to move city so they could be closer to, I think they're at a Ronald McDonald House, so that they can get medical care for the kid, who is apparently very sweet and very lovely, but just so premature that they've had some, that she requires a lot of medical intervention. So the two of them are a little distracted, but they've said, you know, provisionally they're accepting the story, and I assume that the edits will be pretty minor. Certainly hope so. In any event, that's all just a long-winded way of telling you that for various reasons, this story may not run as it appears in this podcast. It may run with some edits. This is a first draft. So without further ado, then, I will start reading to you from Clockwork Fagin, a short story that runs, let's see, how long does it run? 12,500 words, and will probably take me a couple of months to read through on this podcast. Here we go. Clockwork Fagin by Cory Doctorow. Monty Goldfarb walked into St. Agatha's like he owned the place. A superior look on the half of his face that was still intact, a spring in his step despite his steel left leg. And it wasn't long before he did own the place, taken it over by simple murder and cunning artifice. It wasn't long before he was my best friend and my master too, and the master of all St. Agatha's, and didn't he preside over a golden era in the history of that miserable place. I've lived at St. Agatha's since I was 11 years old, when a reciprocating gear in the muddy York Hall of Computation took off my right arm at the elbow. My dad had sent me off to muddy York when Ma died of the consumption. He'd sold me into service of the computers, and I'd thrived in the big city, hadn't cried, not even once, not even when Master Saunders beat me for playing kick the can with the other boys when I was meant to be polishing the brass. I didn't cry when I lost my arm, nor when the barber surgeon clamped me off and burned my stump with his medicinal tar. I've seen every kind of boy and girl come to St. Aggie's, swaggering, scared, tough, meek. The burned ones are often the hardest to read, inscrutable beneath their scars. Old Grinder doesn't care, though, not one bit. Angry or scared, burned and hobbling or swaggering and full of beans, the first thing he does when new meat turns up on his doorstep is tenderize it a little. That means a good long session with the belt, and Grinder doesn't care where the strap lands, whole skin or fresh scars, it's all the same to him. And then a night or two down the hole where there's no light and no warmth and nothing for company except for the big, hairy, muddy York rats who'll come and nibble at whatever's left of you if you manage to fall asleep. It's the blood, you see, it draws them out. So there we all was that first night when Monty Goldfarb turned up, dropped off by a pair of sour-faced sisters in white capes who turned up their noses at the smell of the horse droppings as they stepped out of their coal-fired banger and handed Monty over to the Grinder, who smiled and dry-washed his hairy hands and promised, "Oh, aye, sisters, I shall look after this poor crippled little birdie like he was my own get. We'll be great friends, won't we, Monty?" Monty actually laughed when Grinder said that, like he'd already winkled it out. As soon as the boiler on the sister's car had its head of steam up and they were clanking away, Grinder took Monty inside, leading him past the parlor where we all sat, quiet as mice, eyeless or armless, shy a leg or half a face, or even a scalp, as was little Gertie Shinepate, whose hair got caught in the mighty rollers of one of the pressing engines down at the logic mill in Cabbage Town. He gave us a jaunty wave as Grinder led him away, and I'm ashamed that none of us had the stuff to wave back at him, or even to shout a warning. Grinder had done his work on us, too true, and turned us from kids into cowards. Presently, we heard the whistle and the slap of the strap, but instead of screams of agony, we heard howls of defiance and, yes, even laughter. "Is that the best you have, you greasy old sack of suet? Put some arm into it!" And then, "Oh, dearie me, you must be tiring of your work. See how the sweat runs down your face, how your tongue doth protrude from your stinking gob. Oh, please, dear master, tell me your pathetic old ticker isn't about to pack it in. I don't know what I'd do if you dropped dead here on the floor before me." And then your chest heaves like a bellows. Is this what passes for a beating round here? Oh, when I get the strap, old man, I will show you how we beat a man in Montreal. You may count on it, my sweet. The way he carried on, you think he was enjoying the beating, and I had a picture of him leaping to and fro, avoiding the strap with the curious skipping jump of a one-legged boy, but when Grinder led him past the parlor again, he looked half dead. The good side of his face was a pulpy mess, and his one eye was near swollen shut, and he walked with even more of a limp than he'd had coming in. But he grinned at us again and spat a tooth on the threadbare rug that we were made to sweep 3 times a day, a tooth that left a trail of blood behind it on the splintery floor. We heard the thud as Monty was tossed down into the hole's dirt floor, and then the labored breathing as Grinder locked him in, and then the singing, loud and distinct, from under the floorboards. Come gather ye, good children, good news to you I'll tell, but how the Grinder bastard will roast and rot in hell. There was more, apparently improvised. Later, I'd hear Monty improvise many and many a song, using some hymn or popular song for a tune beneath his body and obscene lyrics, and we all strove to keep the smiles from our face as Grinder stamped back into his rooms, shooting us dagger looks as he passed by the open door. And that was the day Monty came to St. Agatha's home for the rehabilitation of crippled children. I remember my first night in the hole, a time that seemed to stretch into infinity, a darkness so deep I thought that perhaps I'd gone blind. And most of all, I remember the sound of the cellar door loosening, the bar being shifted, the ancient hinges squeaking, the blinding light stabbing into me from above, and the silhouette of old Grinder holding out one of his hairy, long-fingered hands for me to catch hold of, like an angel come to rescue me from the pits of Hades. Grinder pulled me out of the hole like a man pulling up a carrot, with a gesture practiced on many other children over the year, and I near wept from gratitude. I'd soiled my trousers, and I couldn't hardly see nor speak for my dry throat, and every sound and sight was magnified 1,000-fold as I put my face in his great coat, there in the horrible smell of the man and the muscle beneath like a side of beef, and I cried like he was my old ma'am come to get me out of a fever bed. I remember this, and I ain't proud of it, and I never spoke of it to any other of the St. Aggie's children, nor did they speak of it to me. I was broken then, and I was Grinder's boy, and when he turned me out later that day with a begging bowl, sent me down to the distillery and off to the ports to approach the navvies and the lobster backs for a halfpenny or a groat or a tuppence, I went out like a grateful doggie, and never once thought of putting any of Grinder's money by in a secret place for my own spending. Of course, over time I did get less doggy and more wolf about the Grinder, dreamt of tearing out his throat with my teeth, and Grinder always seemed to know when the doggy was going, because bung, you'd be back in the hole before you had a chance to chance old Grinder. A day or two downstairs would bring the doggy back out, especially if Grinder tenderized you some with his strap before he heaved you down the stairs. I'd seen big boys and rough girls come to St. Aggie's, hard as boots, and come out of Grinder's hole so good doggy that they practically licked his boots for him. Grinder understood, children, I'll give you that. Give us a mean, hard father of a man who doles out punishment and protection like old Jehovah from the sisters' hymnals, and we line up to take his orders. But Grinder didn't understand Monty Goldfarb. I'd just come down to lay the long tables for breakfast, it was my turn that day, when I heard Grinder shoot the lock to his door and then the sound of his calluses rasping on the polished brass knob. As his door swung open, I heard the music box playing its tune, Grinder's favorite, a Scottish hymn that the music box sung in Gaelic, its weird horse-gut voice box making the old words even weirder, like the eldritch crooning of some crone in a street play. Grinder's heavy tramp receded down the hall, to the cellar door. The doors creaked open, and I felt a shiver down in my stomach, and down below that, in my stones, as I remembered my times in the pit. There was the thunder of his heavy boots on the step, then his cruel laughter as he beheld Monty. Oh, my darling, is this how they take their punishment in Montreal? 'Tis no wonder the Frenchies lost their wars to the Upper Canadians, with such weak little mice as you to fight for them. They came back up the stairs, Grinder's jaunty tromp, Monty's dragging, beaten limp. Down the hall they went, and I heard poor Monty reaching out to steady himself, brushing the framed drawings of Grinder's horrible ancestors as he went, and I flinched with each squeak of a picture knocked askew, for disturbing Grinder's forebears was a beating offense at St. Aggie's. But Grinder must have been feeling charitable, for he did not pause to whip beaten Monty that morning. And so they came into the dining hall, and I did not raise my head, but beheld them from the corner of my eyes, taking cutlery from the basket hung over the hook at my right elbow, and laying it down neat and precise on the splintery tables. Each table had 3 hard loaves on it, charity bread, donated from Muddy York's bakeries to us poor crippled kiddies, day old and more than a day old, and tough as stone. Before each loaf was a knife as long as a man's forearm, sharp as a butcher's, and the head child at each table was responsible for slicing the bread using the knife each day. Children who were shy an arm or two were exempted from this duty, for which I was thankful, since those children were always accused of favoring some child with a thicker slice, and fights were common. Monty was leaning heavily on Grinder, his head down and his steps like those of an old, old man, first a click of his steel foot, then a dragging from his remaining leg. But as they passed the head of the furthest table, Monty sprang from Grinder's side, took up the knife, and with a sure, steady hand, a movement so spry, I knew he'd been shamming from the moment Grinder opened up the cellar door, he plunged the knife into Grinder's barrel chest, just over his heart, and shoved it home, giving it a hard twist. He stepped back to consider his handiwork. Grinder was standing perfectly still, his face pale beneath his whiskers, and his mouth was working, and I could almost hear the words he was trying to get out, words I'd heard so many times before. Oh, my lovely, you are a naughty one, but Grinder will beat the devil out of you, purify you with rod and fire, have no fear. But no sound escaped Grinder's furious lips. Monty put his hands on his hips and watched him with the critical eye of a bricklayer or a machinist surveying his work. Then, calmly, he put his good right hand on Grinder's chest, just to one side of the knife handle. He said, "Oh no, Mr. Grindersworth, this is how we take our punishment in Montreal." Then he gave the smallest of pushes, and Grinder went over like a chimney that's been hit by a wrecking ball. He turned then and regarded me full on, the good side of his face alive with mischief, the mess on the other side a wreck of burned skin. He winked his good eye at me and said, "Now he was a proper pile of filth and muck, wasn't he? World's a better place now, I dare say." He wiped his hands on his filthy trousers, grimed with the brown dirt of the cellar, and held it out to me. "Montague Goldfarb, machinist boy and prentice artificer, late of old Montreal. Montreal Monty, if you please," he said. I tried to say something, anything, and realized that I'd bitten the inside of my cheek so hard I could taste the blood. I was so discombobulated that I held out my abbreviated right arm to him, hook and cutlery basket and all, something I hadn't done since I'd first lost the limb. Truth told, I was a little tender and shy about my mutilation, didn't like to think about it, and especially I couldn't bear to see whole people shying back from me as though I were some kind of monster. But Monty just reached out, calm as you like, and took my whole hand with his cunning fingers, fingers so long they seemed to have an extra joint, and shook my hook as though it were a whole hand. "Sorry, mate, didn't catch your name." I tried to speak again, and this time I found my voice. "Sean O'Leary," I said. "Antrim Town, then Hamilton, and then here." I wondered what else to say. "Third grade computerman's boy, once upon a time." "Oh, that's fine," he said. "Skilled tradesmen's helpers are what we want around here. You know the lads and lasses round here, Sean. Are there any more like you? Children who can make things, should they be called upon?" I nodded. It was queer to be holding this calm conversation over the cooling body of Grinder, who now spelt of the ordure his slack bowels had loosed into his fine trousers. But it was also natural, somehow, caught in the burning gaze of Monty Goldfarb, who had the attitude of a master in his shop, running the place with utter confidence. "Capital!" He nudged Grinder with his toe. "That meat'll spoil soon enough, but before he does, let's have some fun, shall we? Give us a hand." He bent and lifted Grinder under one arm. He nodded his head at the remaining arm. "Come on," he said, and I took it, and we lifted the limp corpse of Zophar Grindersworth, the Grinder of St. Aggie's, and propped him up at the head of the middle table, knife handle protruding from his chest amid a spreading stain over his blue brocade waistcoat. Monty shook his head. "That won't do," he said, and picked up a tea towel from a pile by the kitchen door and tied it around Grinder's throat like a bib, fussing with it until he had more or less disguised the grisly wound. Then Monty picked up one of the loaves from the end of the table and tore a hunk off the end. He chewed at it like a cow at her cud for some time, never taking his eyes at me. Then he swallowed and said, "Hungry work," and laughed with a spray of crumbs. He paced the room, picking up the cutlery I'd laid and inspecting it, gnawing at the loaf's end in his hand thoughtfully. "A pretty poor setup," he said, "but I'm sure that wicked old lizard had a pretty soft nest for himself, didn't he?" I nodded and pointed down the hall to Grinder's door. "The key's on his belt," I said. Monty fingered the key ring chained to the Grinder's thick leather belt, then shrugged. "All one cylinder jobs," he said, and picked a fork out of the basket that was still hanging from my hook. "Nothing to them, faster than fussing with his belt." He walked purposefully down the hall, his metal foot thumping off the polished wood, leaving dents in it. He dropped to one knee at the lock, then put the fork under his steel foot and used it as a lever to bend back all but one of the soft pot metal tines. So now the fork had just one long thin spike. He slid it into the lock, felt for a moment, then gave a sharp and precise flick of his wrist and twisted open the doorknob. It opened smoothly at his touch. "Nothing to it," he said, and got back to his feet, dusting off his knees. Now, I'd been in Grinder's rooms many times, when I brought in the boiling water for his bath, or run the rug sweeper over his thick Turkish rugs, or dusted the frame medals and certificates and the cunning machines he kept in his apartment. But this was different, because this time I was coming in with Monty, and Monty made you ask yourself, why isn't this all mine? Why shouldn't I just take it? And I didn't have a good answer, apart from fear, and fear was giving way to excitement. Monty went straight to the humidor by Grinder's deep plush chair and brought out a fistful of cigars. He handed one to me and we both bit the tips off and spat them on the fine rug, then lit them with a polished brass lighter in the shape of a beautiful woman that stood to the other side of the chair. Monty clamped his cheroot between his teeth and continued to paw through Grinder's sacred possessions, all the fine goods that the children of St. Aggie's weren't even allowed to look closely upon. Soon he was swilling Grinder's best brandy from a lead crystal decanter, wearing Grinder's red velvet housecoat, topped with Grinder's fine beaver skin bowler hat. And it was thus attired that he stumped back into the dining room, where the corpse of Grinder still slumped at the table's end, and took up a stance by the old ship's bell that the morning child used to call the rest of the kiddies to breakfast, and he began to ring the bell like St. Aggie's was afire, and he called out as he did, a wordless, bird-like call, something like a rooster's crowing, such a noise as never been heard in St. Aggie's before. With a clatter and a clank and 100 muffled arguments, the children of St. Aggie's pelted down the staircases and streamed into the kitchen, milling uncertainly, eyes popping at the sight of our latest arrival in his stolen finery, still ringing the bell, still making his crazy call, stopping now and again to swill the brandy and laugh and spray a boozy cloud before him. Once we were all standing in our nightshirts and underclothes, every scar and stump on display, he left off his ringing and cleared his throat ostentatiously, then stepped nimbly onto one of the chairs, wobbling for an instant on his steel peg, then leapt again like a goat leaping from rock to rock, up onto the table, sending my carefully laid cutlery clattering every which away. He cleared his throat and said, "Good morrow to you, good morrow all, good morrow to the poor, crippled, abused children of St. Aggie's. We haven't been properly introduced, so I thought it fitting that I should take a moment to greet you all and share a bit of good news with you. My name is Montreal Monty Goldfarb, machinist boy, prentice artificer, gentleman adventurer, and liberator of the oppressed. I am late foreshortened," he waggled his stumps, "as are so many of you, and yet, I say to you, I am as good a man as I was ere I lost my limbs, and I say that you are too." There was a cautious murmur at this. It was the kind of thing that the sisters said to you in the hospital before they brought you to St. Aggie's, the kind of pretty lies they told you about the wonderful life that awaited you with your new crippled body once you had been retrained and put to productive work. Children of St. Aggie's, hearken to old Montreal Monty, and I will tell you of what is possible and what is necessary. First, what is necessary? To end oppression wherever we find it, to be liberators of the downtrodden and the meek. When that evil dog's pizzle flogged me and threw me in his dungeon, I knew that I'd come upon a bully, a man who poisoned the sweet air with each breath of his cursed lungs, and so I resolved to do something about it. And so I have. He clattered the table's length to where Grinder's body slumped. Many of the children had been so fixated on the odd spectacle that Monty presented that they hadn't even noticed the extraordinary sight of our tormentor sat, apparently sleeping or unconscious. With the air of a magician, Monty bent and took the end of the tea towel and gave it a sharp yank, so that all could see the knife handle protruding from the red stain that covered Grinder's chest. We gasped, and some of the more faint-hearted children shrieked, but no one ran off to get the law, and no one wept a single salty tear for our dead benefactor. Monty held his arms over his head in a wide V and looked expectantly upon us. It only took a moment before someone, perhaps it was me, began to applaud, to cheer, to stomp, and then we were all at it, making such a noise as you might encounter in a tavern full of men who just learned that their side had won a war. Monty waited for it to die down a bit, then, with a theatrical flourish, he pushed Grinder out of his chair, letting him slide to the floor with a meaty thump, and settled himself into the chair the corpse had lately sat upon. The message was clear. I am now the master of this house. I cleared my throat and raised my good arm. I'd had more time than the rest of the St. Aggie's children to consider life without the terrible Grinder, and a thought had come to me. Monty nodded regally at me, and I found myself standing with every eye in the room upon me. "Monty," I said, "on behalf of the children of St. Aggie's, I thank you most sincerely for doing away with cruel old Grinder, but I must ask you, what shall we do now? With Grinder gone, the sisters will surely shut down St. Aggie's, or perhaps send us another vile old master to beat us, and you shall go to the gallows at King Street Jail, and, well, it just seems a pity that—" I waved my stump. "It just seems a pity is what I'm saying." Monty nodded again. "Sean, I thank you, for you have come neatly to my next point. I spoke of what was needed and what was possible, and now we must discuss what is possible. I had a nice long time to meditate on this question through last night as I languished in the pit below, and I think I have a plan, though I shall need your help with it if we are to pull it off." He stood again and took up a loaf of hard bread and began to wave it like a baton as he spoke, thumping it on the table for emphasis. "Item. I understand that the sisters provide for St. Aggie's with such alms as are necessary to keep our lamps burning, fuel in our fireplaces, and gruel and such on the table. Yes?" We nodded. "Right. Item. Nevertheless, old turd gargler here was used to sending you poor kiddies out to beg with your wounds all on display, to bring him whatever coppers you could coax from the drunkards of Muddy York, with which to feather his pretty little nest yonder. Correct?" We nodded again. "Right. Item. We are all of us the crippled children of Muddy York's great information processing factories. We are artificers, machinists, engineers, cunning shapers, and makers every one, for that is how we came to be injured. Correct? Right. Item. It is a murdersome pity that we should be turned out to beg when we have so much skill at our disposal. Between us, we could make anything, do anything, but our departed tormentor lacked the native wit to see this. Correct? Right. Item. The sisters of the Simpering Order of St. Agatha's Weeping Sores have all the cleverness of a turnip. I saw this for myself during my tenure at their hospital. Fooling them will be easier than fooling an idiot child. Correct? Right. He levered himself out of the chair and began to stalk the dining room, stumping up and down. "Someone tell me, how often do the good sisters pay us a visit?" "Sundays," I said, "when they take us all to church." He nodded. "And does that spoiled meat there accompany us to church?" "No," I said. "No, he stays here. He says he worships in his own way." Truth was, he was invariably too hung over to rise on a Sunday. He nodded again. "And today is Tuesday, which means that we have 5 days to do our work." "What work, Monty?" "Why, we are going to build a clockwork automaton based on that evil tyrant what I slew this very morning. We will build a device of surpassing and fiendish cleverness, such as will fool the nuns and the world at large into thinking that we are still being ground up like mincemeat, while we lead a life of leisure, fun, and invention, such as befits children of our mental stature and good character." All right, then. I'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.